This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you An Hour of Short Stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to An Hour of Short Stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. For this program, we have two humor pieces. The first short story is by famed American humorist Mark Twain, and the second by crime writer Lawrence Block. Samuel Clemens, who wrote under the pseudonym Mark Twain, is best known for Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. And he authored travel books based on his many trips to the West, abroad, and around the world. Twain is generally considered America's greatest humorist, yet despite his extraordinary sense of humor, Twain was melancholy and often depressed. Many of his works are satirical attacks on current events. Twain, who was born in Florida, Missouri in 1835, died in 1910 in Elmira, New York, where he is buried. Here is The McWilliamses and the Burglar Alarm, which was a challenge to read because I kept bursting into laughter. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The conversation drifted smoothly and pleasantly along, from weather to crops, from crops to literature, from literature to scandal, from scandal to religion, and then took a random jump and landed on the subject of burglar alarms. And now, for the first time, Mr. McWilliam showed feeling. Whenever I perceive this sign on this man's dial, I comprehend it and lapse into silence and give him opportunity to unload his heart. Said he, with but ill-controlled emotion, "I do not go one single cent on burglar alarms, Mr. Twain, not a single cent. And I will tell you why. When we were finishing our house, we found we had a little cash left over, on account of the plumber not knowing it. I was for enlightening the heathen with it, for I was always unaccountably down on the heathen somehow. But Mrs. McWilliam said, 'No, let's have a burglar alarm.' I agree to this compromise. I will explain that whenever I want a thing, and Mrs. McWilliams wants another thing, and we decide upon the thing that Mrs. McWilliams wants, as we always do, she calls that a compromise." Very well. The man came up from New York and put in the alarm, and charged $325 for it, and said we could sleep without uneasiness now. So we did for a while, say a month. Then one night we smelled smoke, and I was advised to get up and see what the matter was. I lit a candle and started toward the stairs, and met a burglar coming out of a room with a basket of tinware, which he had mistaken for solid silver in the dark. He was smoking a pipe. I said, "My friend, we do not allow smoking in this room." He said he was a stranger and could not be expected to know the rules of the house. Said he had been in many houses just as good as this one, and it had never been objected to before. He added that as far as his experience went, such rules had never been considered to apply to burglars anyway. I said, "Smoke along then, if it is the custom, though I think that the conceding of a privilege to a burglar, which is denied to a bishop, is a conspicuous sign of the looseness of the times. But waiving all that, what business have you to be entering this house in this furtive and clandestine way, without ringing the burglar alarm?" he looked confused and ashamed, and said with embarrassment, "I beg 1,000 pardons. I did not know that you had a burglar alarm, else I would have rung it. I beg you will not mention it where my parents may hear of it, for they are old and feeble, and such a seemingly wanton breach of the hallowed conventionalities of our Christian civilization might all too rudely sunder the frail bridge which hangs darkling between the pale and evanescent present and the solemn great deeps of the eternities. May I trouble you for a match?" I said, "Your sentiments do not honor, but if you will allow me to say it, metaphor is not your best hold. Spare your thigh. This kind light only on the box, and seldom there, in fact, if my experience may be trusted. But to return to business, how did you get in here?" "Through a second floor window." "It was even so. I redeemed the tinware at pawnbroker's rates, less cost of advertising, bade the burglar good night, closed the window after him, and retired to headquarters to report. Next morning we sent for the burglar alarm man, and he came up and explained that the reason the alarm did not go off was that no part of the house, but for the first floor, was attached to the alarm. This was simply idiotic. One might as well have no armor on at all in battle as to have it only on his legs. The expert now puts the whole second story on the alarm, charged $300 for it, and went his way. By and by one night I found a burglar in the third story, about to start down a ladder with a lot of miscellaneous property. My first impulse was to crack his head with a billiard cue, but my second was to refrain from this attention because he was between me and the cue rack. The second impulse was plainly the soundest, so I refrained and proceeded to compromise. I redeemed the property at former rates after deducting 10% for the use of the ladder, it being my ladder, and next day we sent down for the expert once more and had the third story attached to the alarm for $300. By this time the annunciator had grown to formidable dimensions. It had 47 tags on it, marked with the names of the various rooms and chimneys, and it occupied the space of an ordinary wardrobe. The gong was the size of a washbowl and was placed above the head of our bed. There was a wire from the house to the coachman's quarters in the stable, and a noble gong alongside his pillow. We should have been comfortable now but for one defect. Every morning at 5 the cook opened the kitchen door, in the way of business, and rip went that gong. The first time this happened, I thought the last day was come sure. I didn't think it in bed, no, but out of it, for the first effect of that frightful gong is to hurl you across the house and slam you against the wall and then curl you up and squirm you like a spider on a stove lid till somebody shuts the kitchen door. In solid fact, there is no clamor that is even remotely comparable to the dire clamor which that gong makes. Well, this catastrophe happened every morning regularly at 5 o'clock, and lost us 3 hours' sleep. For, mind you, when that thing wakes you, it doesn't merely wake you in spots. It wakes you all over, conscious and all, and you are good for 18 hours of wide awakeness subsequently. 18 hours of the very most inconceivable wide awakeness that you ever experienced in your life. A stranger died on our hands one time, and we vacated and left him in our room overnight. Did that stranger wait for the general judgment? No, sir. He got up at 5 the next morning in the most prompt and unostentatious way. I knew he would. I knew it mightily well. He collected his life insurance and lived happily ever after, for there was plenty of proof as to the perfect squareness of his death. Well, we were gradually fading toward a better land on account of the daily loss of sleep. So we finally had the expert up again, and he ran a wire to the outside of the door and placed a switch there, whereby Thomas, the butler, always made one little mistake. He switched the alarm off at night when he went to bed, and switched it on again at daybreak in the morning, just in time for the cook to open the kitchen door and enable that gong to slam us across the house, sometimes breaking a window with one or the other of us. At the end of a week, we recognized that this switch business was a delusion and a snare. We also discovered that a band of burglars had been lodging in the house the whole time. Not exactly to steal, for there wasn't much left now, but to hide from the police, for they were hot-pressed, and they shrewdly judged that the detectives would never think of a tribe of burglars taking sanctuary in a house notoriously protected by the most imposing and elaborate burglar alarm in America. Sent down for the expert again, and this time he struck a most dazzling idea. He fixed the thing so that opening the kitchen door would take off the alarm. It was a noble idea, and he charged accordingly. But you already foresee the result. I switched on the alarm every night at bedtime, no longer trusting on Thomas's frail memory. And as soon as the lights were out, the burglars walked in at the kitchen door, thus taking the alarm off, without waiting for the cook to do it in the morning. You see how aggravatingly we were situated. For months we couldn't have any company, not a spare bed in the house, all occupied by burglars. Finally, I got up a cure of my own. The expert answered the call and ran another ground wire to the stable and established a switch there so that the coachman could put on and take off the alarm. That worked first rate, and a season of peace ensued, during which we got to inviting company once more and enjoying life. But by and by the irrepressible alarm invented a new kink. One winter's night we were flung out of bed by the sudden music of that awful gong, and when we hobbled to the annunciator, turned up the gas, and saw the word nursery exposed, Mrs. McWilliams fainted dead away, and I came precious near doing the same thing myself. I seized my shotgun and stood timing the coachman whilst that appalling buzzer went on. I knew that his gong had flung him out too, and that he would be along as soon as he could jump into his clothes. When I judged that the time was ripe, I crept to the room next to the nursery, glanced through the window, and saw the dim outline of the coachman in the yard below, standing at present arms and waiting for a chance. Then I hopped into the nursery and fired, and in the same instant the coachman fired at the red flash of my gun. Both of us were successful. I crippled a nurse, and he shot off all my back hair. We turned up the gas and telephoned for a surgeon. There was not a sign of a burglar, and no window had been raised. One glass was absent, but that was where the coachman's charge had come through. Here was a fine mystery. The burglar alarm, going off at midnight of its own accord, and not a burglar in the neighborhood. The expert answered the usual call and explained that it was a false alarm, said it was easily fixed. So he overhauled the nursery window, charged a remunerative figure for it, and departed. What we suffered from false alarms for the next 3 years, no stylographic pen can describe. During the next 3 months, I always flew with my gun to the room indicated, and the coachman always sallied forth with his battery to support me. But there was never anything to shoot at. Windows all tight and secure. We always sat down for the expert next day, and he fixed those particular windows so they would keep quiet a week or so, and always remembered to send us a bill about like this. Wire, $2.15. Nipple, 75 cents. 2 hours labor, $1.50. Wax, 47 cents. Tape, 34 cents. Screws, 15 cents. Recharging battery, 98 cents. 3 hours labor, 225. String, 2 cents. Lard, 66 cents. Pond's extract, $1.25. Springs at 50, $2. Railroad fares, 7.25. Total, $19.77. At length, a perfectly natural thing came about. After we had answered 300 or 400 false alarms, to wit, we stopped answering them. Yes, I simply rose up calmly, then slammed across the house by the alarm, calmly inspected the annunciator, took note of the room indicated, and then calmly disconnected that room from the alarm and went back to bed as if nothing had happened. Moreover, I left that room off permanently and did not send for the expert. Well, it goes without saying that in the course of time, all the rooms were taken off and the entire machine was out of service. It was at this unprotected time that the heaviest calamity of all happened. The burglars walked in one night and carried off the burglar alarm. Yes, sir, every hide and hair of it, ripped it out, tooth and nail, springs, bells, gongs, battery, and all. They took 150 miles of copper wire. They just cleaned her out, bag and baggage, and never left us a vestige of her to swear at. Swear by, I mean. We had a time of it to get her back, but we accomplished this finally. For money. The alarm firm said that what we needed now was to have her put in right, with her new patent springs in the windows to make false alarms impossible, and their new patent clock attached to take off and put on the alarm morning and night without human assistance. That seemed a good scheme. They promised to have the whole thing finished in 10 days. They began work, and we left for the summer. They worked a couple of days, then they left for the summer, after which the burglars moved in and began their summer vacation. When we returned in the fall, the house was as empty as a beer closet in premises where painters have been at work. We refurnished and then sent down to hurry up the expert. He came up and finished the job and said, "Now this clock is set to put on the alarm every night at 10 and take it off every morning at 5:45. All you've got to do is wind her up every week and then leave her alone. She'll take care of the alarm herself." After that, we had a most tranquil season during 3 months. The bill was prodigious, of course, and I had said I would not pay it until the new machinery had proved itself to be flawless. The time stipulated was 3 months. So I paid the bill, and the very next day the alarm went to buzzing like 10,000 bee swarms at 10 o'clock in the morning. I turned the hands around 12 hours according to instructions, and this took the alarm off. But there was another hitch at night, and I had to set her ahead 12 hours once more to get her to put the alarm on again. That sort of nonsense went on a week or two. Then the expert came up and put in a new clock. He came up every 3 months during the next 3 years and put in a new clock. But it was always a failure. His clocks all had the same perverse defect. They would put the alarm on in the daytime, and they would not put it on at night. And if you forced it on yourself, they would take it off again the minute your back was turned. Now, there is the history of that burglar alarm. Everything just as it happened, nothing extenuated, and not set down in malice. Yes, sir, and when I slept 9 years with burglars and maintained an expensive burglar alarm the whole time, for their protection, not mine, and at my sole cost, not for a damned cent, could I ever get them to contribute. I just said to Mrs. McWilliams that I had had enough of that kind of pie, so with her full consent, I took the whole thing out and traded it off for a dog and shot the dog. I don't know what you think about it, Mr. Twain, but I think those things are made solely in the interest of the burglars. Yes, sir, a burglar alarm combines in its person all that is objectionable about a fire, a riot, and a harem, and at the same time has none of the compensating advantages, of one sort or another, that customarily belong with that combination. Goodbye. I get off here. Crime writer Lawrence Block was born in Buffalo, New York in 1938. He has published more than 50 novels and 100 short stories, most set in New York, where he lives, along with a series of books for writers. He was named a Grand Master by Mystery Writers of America and was thrice the recipient of the Edgar Award. His most popular characters are thief Bernie Rodenbar and private investigator and recovering alcoholic Matthew Scudder. The Bernie Rodenbar work, entitled Burglar in the Closet, was made into the film Burglar, with Whoopi Goldberg as Bernice. From among Block's works, we have chosen The Detweiler Solution. Sometimes you just can't win for losing. Business was so bad over at Detweiler Brothers Fine Fashions for Men that Seth Detweiler went on back to the store one Thursday night and poured out a 5-gallon can of lead-free gasoline, where he figured as it would do the most good. He lit a fresh Philip Morris King size and balanced it on the edge of the counter so as it would burn for a couple of minutes and then get unbalanced enough to drop into the pool of gasoline. Then he got into an Oldsmobile that was about 5 days clear of a repossession notice and drove on home. You couldn't have had a better fire dropping napalm on a paper mill. Time it was done, you could sift those ashes and not find so much as a collar button. It was far and away the most spectacular total fire Schuyler County had ever seen, so much so that Maybrook Fidelity Insurance
would have been a little tentative about settling a claim under ordinary circumstances. But the way things stood, there wasn't the slightest suspicion of arson. Because what kind of a dim-witted hulk goes and burns down his business establishment a full week after his fire insurance has lapsed? No fooling. See, it was Seth's brother Porter who took care of paying bills and such, and a little over a month ago the fire insurance payment had been due, and Porter looked at the bill and at the bank balance and back and forth for a while, and then he put the bill in a drawer. 2 weeks later, there was a reminder notice, and 2 weeks after that, there was a notice that the grace period had expired and the insurance was no longer in force. And then a week after that, there was one pluperfect hell of a bonfire. Seth and Porter had always got on pretty good. They took after each other quite a bit, folks said, especially Porter. Seth was 42 years of age, and he had that long Detweiler face topping a jutting Van Dyne jaw. Their mother was a Van Dyne hailing from just the other side of Oak Falls. Porter was 39, equipped with the same style face and jaw. They both had black hair that lay flat on their heads, like shoe polish put on in a slapdash fashion. Seth had more hair left than Porter, in spite of being the older brother by 3 years. I could describe them in greater detail, right down to scars and warts and sundry distinguishing marks, but it's my guess that you'd enjoy reading all about that as much as I'd enjoy writing it, which is to say less than somewhat. So let's get on with it. I was saying they got on pretty good, rarely raising their voices one to the other, rarely disagreeing seriously about anything much. Now the fire didn't entirely change the habits of a lifetime, but you couldn't honestly say that it did anything to improve their relationship. You'd have to allow that it caused a definite strain.
"What I can't understand," Seth said, "is how anybody who is fool enough to let fire insurance lapse can be an even greater fool for not telling his brother about it. That, in a nutshell, is what I can't understand." "What beats me," Porter said, "is how the same person who has the nerve to fire a place of business for the insurance also does so without consulting his partner, especially when his partner just happens to be his brother." "All as I was trying to do," said Seth, "was save you from the criminal culpability of being an accessory before, to, and after the fact, plus figuring you might be too chicken-hearted to go along with it." "All as I was trying to do," said Porter, "was to save you from worrying about financial matters you would be powerless to contend with, plus figuring it would be just an occasion for me to hear further from you on the subject of those bow ties." "Well, you did buy one powerful lot of bow ties." "I knew it. Something like a Pullman car full of bow ties. And it's not like every man and boy in Schuyler County's been getting this mad passion for bow ties of late." "I just knew it. I wasn't the one brought up the subject, and since you went and mentioned those bow ties..." "Maybe I should have mentioned the spats," Porter said. "Oh, I don't want to hear about spats." "No more than I wanted to hear about bow ties. Did we sell one single damn pair of spats?" "We did." "We did?" "Fella bought one about 15 months back. Had Maryland plates on his car, as I recall. Said he always wanted spats and didn't know they still made them." "Well, selling one pair out of a gross isn't too bad." "Now you leave off," Seth says. "And you leave off of bow ties?" "I guess." "Anyway, the bow ties and spats all burned up in the same damn fire," Porter said. "You know what they say about ill winds," Seth said. "I guess there's a particle of truth in it, what they say."
While it didn't do the Detweiler brothers much good to discuss spats and bow ties, it didn't solve their problems to leave off mentioning spats and bow ties. By the time they finished their conversation, all they were back to was square one, and the view from that spot wasn't the world's best. The only solution was bankruptcy, and it didn't look to be all that much of a solution.
"I don't mind going bankrupt,"
one of the brothers said. I think it was Seth. Makes no never mind, actually. Seth, Porter, it's all the same who said it.
"I don't mind going bankrupt, but I sure do hate the thought of being broke."
"Me too,"
said the other brother, Porter probably.
"I've thought about bankruptcy from time to time."
"Me too. But there's a time and place for bankruptcy."
"Well, the place is all right. No better place for bankruptcy than Schuyler County."
"That's true enough,"
said Seth, unless it was Porter.
"But this is surely not the time. Time to go bankrupt is in good times when you've got a lot of money on hand. Only the damnedest kind of fools goes bankrupt when he's stony broke, busted, and there's a depression going on."
What they were both thinking on during this conversation was a fellow named Joe Bob Rathburton, who was in the construction business over to the other end of Schuyler County. I myself don't know of a man in this part of the state with enough intelligence to bail out a leaky rowboat who doesn't respect Joe Bob Rathburton to hell and back as a man with a good business sense. It was about 2 years ago that Joe Bob went bankrupt, and he did it the right way. First of all, he did it coming off the best year's worth of business he'd ever done in his life. Then what he did was paid off the car and the house and the boat and put them all in his wife's name. His wife was Mabel Washburn, but no relation to the Washburns who have the Schuyler County First National Bank. That's another family entirely. Once that was done, Joe Bob took out every loan and raised every dollar he possibly could, and he turned all that capital into green folding cash and sealed it in quart mason jars, which he buried out back of an old kefir pear tree that's 60-plus years old and still bears fruit like crazy. And then he declared bankruptcy and sat back on his mission rocker with a beer and a cigar and a real big tooth smile.
"If I could think of anything worth doing,"
Porter Detweiler said one night,
"why, I guess I'd just go ahead and do it."
"Can't argue with that,"
Seth said.
"But I can't,"
Porter said.
"Nor I either.
You might pass that old jug over here for a moment. Soon as I pour a tad for myself, if you have no objection."
"None whatsoever," said Porter.
They were over at Porter's place on the evening when this particular conversation occurred. They had taken to spending most of their evenings at Porter's on account of Seth had a wife at home, plus a daughter named Rachel who'd been working at the Ben Franklin store ever since dropping out of the junior college over at Monroe Center. Seth didn't have but one daughter. Porter had two sons and a daughter, but they were all living with Porter's ex-wife, who had divorced him 2 years back and moved clear to Georgia. They were living in Valdosta now, as far as Porter knew. At least that was where he sent the check every month.
"Alimony jail," said Porter.
"How's that?"
"What I said was alimony jail, where you go when you quit paying on your alimony."
"They got a special jug set aside for men don't pay their alimony?"
"Just an expression. I guess they put you into whatever jug's the handiest. All I got to do is quit sending Gert her checks and let her have them cart me away. Get 3 meals a day and a roof over my head, and the whole world could quit nagging me night and day for money I haven't got.
You could never stand it, being in a jail day in and day out, night in and night out."
"I know it," Porter said unhappily. "There anything left in that there jug on the subject of jugs?"
"Some. Anyway, you haven't paid Gert a penny for how long? 3 months?"
"Call it 5. And she ain't throwed you in jail yet. Least you haven't got her close to hand so she can talk money to you."
"Linda May given you any trouble?"
"She did. Keeps a civil tongue since I beat up on her the last time."
"Lord knew what he was doing,"
Porter said, making men stronger than women.
You ever give any thought to what life would be like if wives could beat up on their husbands instead of the other way round?
Now, I don't even want to think about that, Seth said.
You'll notice nobody was mentioning spats or bow ties, even with the jug of corn getting discernibly lighter every time it passed from one set of hands to the other. These two subjects did not come up. Neither did anyone speak of the short-sightedness of failing to keep up fire insurance or the myopia of incinerating a building without ascertaining that such insurance was in force. Tempers had cooled with the ashes of Detweiler Brothers' fine fashions for men, and once again Seth and Porter were on the best of terms, which just makes what happened thereafter all the more tragic.
"What I think I got," Porter said, "is no way to turn."
This wasn't the same evening, but if you put the two evenings side by side under a microscope, you'd be hard-pressed to tell them apart, each from the other. They were at Porter's little house over alongside the tracks of the old spur off the Wyandotte and Southern, which I couldn't tell you when was the last time there was a train on that spur. And they had their feet up and their shoes off, and there was a jug of corn in the picture. Most of the evenings had come to take on this particular shade.
"Couldn't get work if I wanted to," Porter said, "which I don't, and if I did, I couldn't make enough to matter, and my debts is up to my ears and rising steady."
"It doesn't look to be getting better," Seth said. "On the other hand, how can it get worse?"
"I keep thinking the same."
"And?"
"And it keeps getting worse."
"I guess you know what you're talking about," Seth said.
He scratched his bulldog chin, which hadn't been in the same room with the razor in more than a day or two.
"What I've been thinking about," he said, "is killing myself."
"You've been thinking of that?"
"Sure have."
"I think on it from time to time myself," Porter admitted. "Mostly nights when I can't sleep. It can be a powerful comfort round about 3 in the morning. You think of all the different ways, and the next thing you know, you're asleep. Beats the stuffing out of counting sheep jumping fences. You seen one sheep, you seen 'em all, has always been my thoughts on the subject, whereas there's any number of ways of doing away with yourself. I take a certain satisfaction in it," Seth said, more or less warming to the subject. "What I'd leave is a note telling Linda May how her and Rachel be taken care of with the insurance, just to get the bitch's hope up. And then she can find out for her own self that I cashed in that insurance back in January to make the payment on the Oldsmobile. You know, it's pure uncut hell getting along without an automobile now."
"You don't have to tell me."
"Just put a rope around my neck," said Seth, smothering a hiccup, "and my damn troubles will be over."
"And mine in the bargain," Porter said.
"By doing yourself in?"
"Be no need," Porter said, "if you did yourself in."
"How ye figure that?"
"What I figure is $100,000, Porter said. "Lord love a duck. If I had $100,000, I could declare bankruptcy and live like a king."
Seth looked at him, got up, walked over to him, and took the jug away from him. He took a swig and socked the cork in place, but kept hold of the jug.
"Brother," he said, "I guess you've had enough of this here."
"What makes you say that, brother?"
"Me killing myself and you getting rich. You don't make sense. What do you think you're talking about anyhow?"
"Insurance," Porter said.
"Insurance. That's what I think I'm talking about. Insurance."
Porter explained the whole thing. It seems there was this life insurance policy that their father had taken out on them when they weren't but boys. Face amount of $100,000, double indemnity for accidental death. It was payable to him while they were alive, but upon his death the beneficiary changed. If Porter was to die, the money went to Seth, and vice versa.
And you knew about this all along?
Sure did, Porter said.
And never cashed it in? Not the policy on me and not the policy on you?
Couldn't cash him in, Porter said.
I guess I woulda if I coulda, but I couldn't, so I didn't. And you didn't let these policies lapse?
Seth said.
On account of occasionally a person can be just the least bit absent-minded and forget about keeping a policy in force? That's been known to happen,
Seth said, looking off to one side.
In matters relating to fire insurance, for example. And I just thought to mention it.
I have a feeling he wasn't the only one to worry on that score. You may have had similar thoughts yourself, figuring you know how the story's going to end. What, with the insurance not valid and all? Set your mind at rest. If that was the way it had happened, I'd never be taking the trouble to write it up for you. I got to select stories with some satisfaction in them if I'm going to stand a chance to selling them to the magazine. And I hope you don't figure I'm sitting here poking away at this typewriter for the sheer physical pleasure of it. If I just want to exercise my fingers, I'll send them walking through the yellow pages, if it's all the same to you.
Couldn't let them lapse, Porter said.
They're all paid up. What you call 20-payment life? Meaning you pay in it for 20 years, and then you got it free and clear.
And the way Pa did it, you can't borrow on it or nothing. All you can do is wait and see who dies.
Well, I'll be.
Except we don't have to wait and see who dies.
Why, I guess not. I just guess a man can take matters into his own hands if he's a mind to.
He surely can, Porter said.
Man wants to kill himself, that's what he can go and do.
No law against it, Porter said.
Now you know, and I know, that that last is not strictly true. There's a definite no-question law against suicide in our state, and most likely in yours as well. It's harder to make it stand up than a calf with four broken legs. However, and I don't recall that anyone hereabouts was ever prosecuted for it, or likely will be, it does make you wonder some what they had in mind writing that particular law into the books.
I'll just have another taste of that there corn, Porter said.
And why don't you have a pull on the jug your own self? You have any idea just when you might go and do it?
I'm studying on it, Seth said.
There's a lot to be said for doing something soon as a man's mind's made up on the subject. Not to be hurrying you or anything of the sort, but they say that he who hesitates is last.
Porter scratched his chin.
Or some such, he said. I might just do it tonight.
By God, Porter said.
Get the damn thing over with. Glory, hallelujah, and my troubles is over.
And so is mine, said Porter.
You'll be in the money then,
said Seth.
And I'll be in the boneyard, and both of us is free and clear. You can just buy me a decent funeral and then go bankrupt in style.
Give you Johnny Milburn's number one funeral, Porter promised. Brass-bound casket and all. I mean, price is no object if I'm going bankrupt anyway. Let old Johnny swing for the money.
You're a damn good man, brother.
You're the best man in the world, brother.
The jug passed back and forth a couple more times. At one point, Seth announced that he was ready, and he was halfway out the door before he recollected that his car had been repossessed, which interfered with his plans to drive it off a cliff. He came back in and sat down again, and had another drink on the strength of it all. And then suddenly he sat forward and stared hard at Porter.
This policy thing, he said.
What about it?
It's on both of us. Is that what you said?
If I said it, then it must be it's the truth.
Well then,
Seth said, and sat back, arms folded on his chest.
Well, then what? Well, then if you was to kill yourself, then I'd get the money and you'd get the funeral. I don't see what you're getting at,
Porter said slowly.
Seems to me either one of us can go and do it,
Seth said.
And here's the two of us just taking it for granted that I'm to be the one to go and do it, and I think we should think on that a little more thoroughly.
Why, being as you're the older, Seth,
what's that got to do with anything?
Why, you got less years to give up.
Still, I'd be giving up all that's left. Older or younger, don't cut no ice.
Porter thought about it.
After all, he said, it was your idea.
That don't cut ice neither. I could mention I got a wife and child.
I could mention I got a wife and three children.
Ex-wife.
All the same.
Let's face it,
Seth said.
Gert and your three don't add up to anything, and neither do Linda May and Rachel.
Got to agree, Porter said.
So?
One thing, you being the one who put us in the mess, what with fire in the store, it just seems you might be the one to get us out of it. You being the one let the insurance lap through your own stupidity. You could get us out of this mess through insurance, thus evening things up again.
Now, talking about stupidity.
Yes, talking about stupidity.
Spats. Bow ties, damn you, bow ties.
You might have known it would come to that. Now, I've told you Seth and Porter generally got along pretty well, and here's further evidence of it. Confronted by such a stalemate, a good many people would have wrote off the whole affair and decided not to take the suicide route at all. But even spats and bow ties could not deflect Seth and Porter from the road they'd figured out as the most logical to pursue. So what they did, one of them tossed a coin and the other one called it while it was in the air, and they let it hit the floor and roll. And I don't recollect whether it was heads or tails, or who tossed and who called. What's significant is that Seth won.
Well now, Seth said, I feel I've been reprieved. Just let me have that coin. I want to keep it for a good luck charm.
2 out of 3. We already said once is as good as a million, Seth said.
So you just forget that 2 out of 3 business. You got a week like we agreed, but if I was you, I'd get over it soon as I could.
I got a week, Porter said.
You'll get a brass-bound casket and everything, and you can have Minnie Lucy Boxwood sing at your funeral if you want. Expense don't matter at all. What's your favorite song?
I suppose Your Cheating Heart.
Minnie Lucy does that real pretty.
I guess she does.
Now you be sure and make it accidental, Seth said. $200,000 goes just about twice as far as $100,000. Won't cost you a thing to make it accidental, just like we talked about it. What I would do is borrow Fitz Chenoweth's half-ton pickup and go up on the old Harburton Road where it takes that curve. Have yourself a belly full of corn and just keep going straight when the road doesn't. Lord knows I almost did that myself enough times without trying. Had two wheels over the edge less than a month ago.
That close.
That close!
I'll be doggone, Porter said. Thing is, Seth went on home after he failed to convince Porter to do it right away, and that was when things began to fall into the muck. Because Porter started thinking things over. I have a hunch it would have worked out about the same way if Porter had won the flip, with Seth thinking things over. They were a whole lot alike, these two, like two peas in a pot. What occurred to Porter was would have Seth have gone through it if he'd lost, and what Porter decided was that he wouldn't.
not that there was any way for him to prove it one way or the other, but when you can't prove something, you generally tend to decide on believing in what you want to believe, and Porter Detweiler was no exception. Seth, he decided, would not have killed himself, and didn't never have no intention of killing himself, which meant that for Porter to go through with killing his own self amounted to nothing more than damned foolishness. Now, it's hard to say just when he figured out what to do, but it was in the next 2 days, because on the third day he went over and borrowed that pickup truck off Fritz Chenoweth. "I got the back all loaded down with a couple sacks of concrete mix and a keg of nails, and I don't know what all," Fritz said. "You want to unload it back in my smaller barn if you need the room."
"Oh, that's all right," Porter told him. "I guess I'll just leave it loaded and be grateful for the traction."
"Well, you keep it overnight if you have a mind," Fritz said.
"I just might do that," Porter said, and he went over to Seth's house. "Let you and me go for a ride," he told Seth. "Something we was talking about the other night, and I went and got me a new slant on it, which the two of us ought to discuss before things go wrong altogether."
"Be right with you," Seth said, "as soon as I finish this sandwich."
"Oh, just bring it along."
"I guess," said Seth.
No sooner was the pickup truck backed down and out of the driveway than Porter said,
"Now, will you just have a look over there, brother?"
"How's that?"
said Seth, and turned his head obligingly to the right, whereupon Porter gave him a good lick upside the head with a monkey wrench he'd brought along expressly for that purpose. He got him right where you have a soft spot if you're a little baby. You also have a soft spot there if someone gets you just right with a monkey wrench. Seth made a little sound which amounted to no more than letting his breath out, and then he went out like an icebox light when you have closed the door on it. Now, as to whether or not Seth was dead at this point, I could not honestly tell you, unless I were to make up an answer knowing how slim is the likelihood of anyone presuming to contradict me. But the plain fact is that he might have been dead, and he might not, and even Seth could not have told you, being at the very least stone unconscious at the time. What Porter did was drive up the old Harburton Road, I guess figuring that he might as well stick to as much of the original plan as possible. There's a particular place where the road does a reasonably convincing imitation of a fish hook, and that spot's been described as Schuyler County's best natural break of the population explosion since they stamped out the typhoid. A whole lot of folks fail to make that curve every year, most of them young ones with plenty of breeding years left in them. Now and then there's a movement to put up a guardrail, but the ecology people are against it, so it never gets anywheres. If you miss that curve, the next gland you touch is a good 500 feet closer to sea level. So Porter pulls over the side of the road and then gets out of the car and maneuvers Seth, or Seth's body, whichever the case may have been, so he's behind the wheel. Then he stands alongside the car, working the gas pedal with one hand and the steering wheel with the other, and putting the fool truck in gear, and doing this and that and the other thing, so he can run the truck up to the edge and over, and thinking hard every minute about those 200,000 pretty green dollars that is destined to make his bankruptcy considerably easier to contend with. Well, I told you right off that sometimes you can't win for losing, which was the case for Porter and Seth both. And another way of putting it is to say that when everything goes wrong, there's nothing goes right. Here's what happened. Porter slipped on a piece of loose gravel while he was pushing, and the truck had to go on its own, and where it went was halfway and no further, with its back wheel hung up on a hunk of tree limb and some such, and its two front wheels hanging out over nothing,
and its motor stalled out deader than smoked fish. Porter set himself a whole mess of bad words. Then he wasted considerable time shoving the back of that truck, forgetting it was in gear and not about to budge. Then he remembered and said a few more bad things and put the thing in neutral, which involved a long reach across Seth to get to the floor shift and a lot of coordination to manipulate it and the clutch pedal at the same time. Then Porter got out of the truck and gave the door a slam, and just about then a beat-up old Chevy with Indiana plates pulls up, and this fellow leaps out screaming that he's got a tow rope and he'll pull the truck to safety. You can't hardly blame Porter for the rest of it. He wasn't the type to be great at contingency planning anyhow, and who could allow for something like this? What he did, he gave this great sob and just plain hurled himself at the back of the truck, it being in neutral now, and the truck went sailing like a kite in a tornado. And Porter? Well, what he did was follow right along after it. It wasn't part of his plan, but he just had himself too much momentum to manage any last-minute change of direction. According to the fellow from Indiana, who it turned out was a veterinarian from Bloomington, Porter fell far enough to get off a couple of genuinely rank words on the way down. Last words or not, you sure wouldn't go and engrave them on any tombstone. Speaking of which, he has the last word in tombstones, Vermont, granite, and all, and his brother Seth has one just like it. They had a double-barreled funeral, the best Johnny Milbourne had to offer, and they each of them reposed in a brass-bound casket, the top-of-the-line model. Minnie Lucy Boxwood sang Your Cheatin' Heart, which was Porter's favorite song. Plus, she sang Seth's favorite song, which was Old Buttermilk Sky. Plus, she also sang free gratis, My Buddy, as a testament to brotherly love. And Linda May and Rachel got themselves $200,000 from the insurance company, which was what Gert and her kids in Valdosta, Georgia also got. And Seth and Porter have an end to their miseries, which was all they really wanted before they got their heads turned around at the idea of all that money. The only thing funnier than how things don't work out is how they do. This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate, and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
While digging for artifacts in the far north, Professor Quantum found a perfectly preserved body of a man. He was overjoyed. He believed the frozen body was none other than Adam from the Bible. What convinced Quantum of that? Thank you.
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The body was missing what Adam would be missing, a belly button. What Quantum didn't know, however, is that a rare condition called umbilical aplasia causes some people, other than Adam, to be born without a belly button.
And now back to our regular programming.